I'm Arun Vanigopal. You're listening to WNYC. Last week, I got a news alert that Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke had reprimanded the superintendent of Joshua Tree National Park for tweeting about climate change. Less than a year into his post, Zinke has a reputation as, quote, Trump's attack dog on the environment. And that happens to be the title of Outside Magazine's recent investigative article. Correspondent Elliot Woods looks at the role Zinke plays in the Trump administration, especially in light of Trump's recent decision to shrink Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. The article is published on Outside Online, and a couple of weeks ago, Elliot Woods and I talked about it. We're re-airing that interview for you today. I began by asking, Zinke's had what you might call an ideological evolution, hasn't he?
I think that's fair to say, although here in Montana where I live, there are plenty of people who will tell you that this is who he was all along and that the put on of being a Teddy Roosevelt conservationist was something that he did for political gain early in his career based on where he was coming from. But certainly the Ryan Zinke that we're seeing now as Secretary of Interior is more brazen than the one that we knew as a congressman or as a state senator.
So you are a Montanan, am I right?
Well, I've lived here for 4 years, but I grew up all over the East Coast and have lived elsewhere as well.
Got it. Well, Zinke himself is a Montanan. So tell us some more about his story so we can get a sense of this arc, this character arc of our Interior Secretary.
Well, the basic story is that Ryan Zinke grew up in a timber and rail town, a working class town in northwest Montana, pretty close to the Canadian border, called Whitefish. And he was a tenacious student. He was class president of his school and a tenacious athlete as well. He played on the football team. He took the football team to its first state championship, a feat that wouldn't be repeated for almost another two decades. And then he went on to play Division I football and become a Navy SEAL. He served in the Navy SEALs for 23 years. So this is a guy who is not going to back down from obstacles to get to where he wants to go. And as a politician, when he first ran for state senate, freshly out of the SEALs, he ran from Whitefish, which is a typical Montana town in a lot of ways. It's got some Republicans and some Democrats and then a lot of independents and a lot of people who are still, even in this age, willing to split the ticket. So Whitefish is, like I said, at the foot of Glacier National Park. It's near Flathead Lake, which is a major tourist destination. And so people there are pretty progressive on the environment compared to other places in the state, like the prairies in the eastern part of the state. So he was able to be this kind of purple Republican, or a what he would call a Teddy Roosevelt Republican. He worked with Democrats in the legislature when he was elected, and that infuriated members of the right wing of his party. He, at one point, arranged with a Democratic state representative from Bozeman to bring the Joint Chiefs to Helena, the state capital, to address a joint session of the legislature on the threat to national security posed by climate change, something that he was also talking to students about at the time. So he was, at that time, a genuine moderate Republican on these issues. In fact, he was so close to the center on these issues that Montana conservation voters, which rates all candidates on their stances on conservation and environmental issues, gave him a rating of 54%, which is the highest rating that a Republican had ever earned. And in his second term in the Senate, he actually did better. I think it was 60%. So then he ran for Congress and became a representative for Montana. And as a representative, he was a fairly party-line Republican on most issues. But still, he was willing to buck the party on important conservation issues. And probably the biggest one is the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which uses excises from the oil industry to fund conservation projects, conservation easement purchases, habitat restoration, and that kind of thing in the states. And Ryan Zinke was always a vocal supporter of that, which very few Republicans are. In fact, when reauthorization of Land and Water Conservation Fund came up in his last year, or I think it was 2015, actually, for reauthorization, and it was in the House Natural Resources Committee, he was the only Republican on the committee to vote for permanent reauthorization of Land and Water Conservation Fund. So he did have a reputation as a conservationist Republican, but, you know, in a sense, the bar is pretty low.
You quote Zinke early on as having said, you should not be afraid to say that you're a Christian, and you should not be afraid to say the government stops at the mailbox, and if you come any further, you're going to meet my gun. I'm wondering,
right.
how do you think his faith plays into his ideas about land stewardship, or has that also evolved?
Well, that's a really interesting issue, because I have read his memoir, and I've talked to people who've known him for a long time, and it was never my understanding that Ryan Zinke's faith was any major part of his identity. And now I think he seems to be playing it up. He likes to end speeches with God bless. He just issued yesterday a kind of public service announcement for Department of Interior staff about his crackdown on sexual harassment, sexual assault within the department. And he ended that with God bless. And very prominently in the background, he had a Bible on a table as a prop. And a cowboy hat over the other shoulder. So it's just my opinion that he is playing up his religiosity in order to court a certain kind of Republican voter. But I'm not sure how authentic that is, and he doesn't make much mention of going to church very often or being a particularly faithful person in his memoir.
I mean, individually, does his story track with a larger shift in terms of how Christianity or a certain segment of Christian America has evolved in terms of its relationship with the land?
I really don't want to put too much into the Ryan Zinke is motivated by his faith or Christianity angle, because I just couldn't verify it, and I don't have a lot to go on there.
Sure.
I think there are really interesting things going on right now with regard to particularly Utah and the public land policies that have been coming out of the Utah delegation, and I think it's impossible to disentangle those from the Mormon Church and the history of the Mormon Church with regard to being persecuted by the federal government and chased across the country, and they have a very defensive stance in that regard. And I think there you definitely have a clear connection, for example, between the Bundy clan. Their fundamentalist Mormon faith definitely animates a lot of their hostility to the federal government. But with Zinke, I think sprinkling a little God bless here and there and making references to Christianity, I think is just part of creating the image of a lock, stock, and barrel electable Republican.
A little decorative. You start by looking at Zinke's rise to power, and that began with his election to the Montana State Senate, where he stated that he believed that ordinary citizens should not have access to 50 caliber rifles, which he eventually walked back, apparently. What made him do that, walk it back?
Well, I think that once Ryan Zinke realized that he was part of the caucus and part of the party, and that he was going to need the party to get to the next level, there are certain arrangements, there are certain pounds of flesh that you have to give in order to get where you want to go in a party machine dominated system. And the GOP on the local, almost all the way down to the county level now, has become increasingly that way. And so I think making certain adjustments to your opinions to please the likes of the National Shooting Sports Association and the National Rifle Association is just par for the course. So he wasn't going to get away with that if he was going to campaign for national office in Montana. And I think that's why he dialed that back.
Okay. Let's talk about this recent push to downsize these monuments, Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase, which you say, quote, took aim at organizations that had been instrumental in launching Zinke's political career. I'm wondering what you meant by, what did you mean by that?
Well, conservation organizations, and I should be clear, to differentiate between conservationists and environmentalists in the Western United States is an important thing to do. Often they're the same. Often they're inseparable. Often someone will consider himself or herself a conservationist and an environmentalist. But when we're talking about Western conservation groups, we're very often including hook and bullet groups, hunting and fishing groups. And so, for example, the Wild Sheep Foundation or Backcountry Hunters and Anglers or the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, Trout Unlimited, these kinds of groups. So a lot of those groups were helpful in burnishing Ryan Zinke's image as he started to campaign for national office. So they were critical of him when he supported deregulation of industry. But when Ryan Zinke got up on the microphone in a public arena and said things like, keep public lands in public hands, or I do not support the sale or transfer of public lands, which is the program coming out of Utah, that made him really popular with some of these groups, or at least they saw in him a potential for a Republican who could push back against what was becoming the dominant thrust of the Republican Party with regard to public lands. So they threw their support to him. For example, the Outdoor Industry of America endorsed Ryan Zinke in his congressional campaign in 2016 against Denise Juneau. And that was a big deal. And the thinking, I think, goes all the way back to his first state Senate run when Montana conservation voters also endorsed him against his Democratic rival because the logic was it would be better to have a so-called green Republican in the Republican caucus than yet another green Democrat. You know, to be a green Democrat is almost a de facto stance now.
Mm-hmm.
But
sure.
These conservation organizations think that they need people within the Republican Party who are willing to push back against their agendas with regard to conservation environment from within. So when Ryan Zinke was nominated to become Secretary of Interior, a lot of these conservation organizations had helped his cause. In fact, Don Trump Jr. was instrumental, so the story goes, in mm-hmm. getting Ryan Zinke's name into consideration for the post. And he's a big hunter. He's a life member of a Missoula, Montana-based organization called Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And definitely the folks from BHA and the folks from the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Partnership and other groups had been involved in helping Don Jr. float Zinke's name for the post because some of the other options were what you might call apocalyptic. I mean, one of the earliest considerations was Sarah Palin. And then you got people who were slightly better, but still pretty radical. Kathy McMorris Rogers from Washington, for example, was a high-profile consideration. So I don't think these groups thought that Zinke was going to be the best Secretary of the Interior in the history of the country, but I think they thought that he would be a bulwark against some of the really dangerous things that would likely come out of the Trump administration with regard to public land and out of this Republican-controlled Congress where Rob Bishop is the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, and he's an extremely aggressive anti-public lands, deregulation-focused congressman from Utah. So I think they thought that he would at least be a kind of bulwark, and right out of the gates, they saw that that was not going to be the case.
I'm Arun Vanikopal, and I'm talking to journalist Elliot Woods about his profile of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Elliot, it's exactly 1 year ago that Outside Magazine published an article titled, Trump's Interior Pick is the Last Hope for Our Public Lands. 1 year ago, and just tell me a little about how that article characterized him just 12 months ago.
Well, that article was written by a writer named Wes Seiler, who runs a editorial column online called Indefinitely Wild that is his. And that was more of an opinion piece by Wes Seiler, I think, and didn't necessarily represent the position of the magazine. But the thrust of the article was everything that I was just saying, that Ryan Zinke had shown that he was willing to stand up for public lands. For example, there was the Land and Water Conservation Fund vote, but then also when the Republican National Committee got together for the convention in Cleveland in July 2016 and introduced their new strategy, there was a plank in the strategy that called for the sale or transfer of public land, which is something, again, that Rob Bishop and these folks have been pushing for. And Ryan Zinke resigned from the convention as a delegate in protest to the adoption of that plank. So that made a lot of headlines. That generated a lot of buzz. And back in Montana, that won him a lot of plaudits. So I think the Seiler piece, the last hope for public lands piece, was responding to that. And there was just a little bit of wind in the sails that, hey, maybe this guy will push back a little bit. Maybe it's not going to be as bad as some folks thought, as long as this guy is there versus somebody like Sarah Palin.
Got it. I'm Arun Vanikopal, and I'm speaking with journalist Elliot Woods about his profile of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke and the fight to preserve public lands in the U.S. Later on in the show, Emily Lin, Kweli Chanda, and Adam Peltzman on the WNYC Studios' first scripted comedy podcast for kids called This Podcast Has Fleas. Plus, Please Explain is all about the stress we've dealt with in 2017. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be right back after a break. Hi, I'm Arun Vanagopal. We're re-airing a conversation I had a few weeks ago with Outside Magazine correspondent Elliot Woods about his profile of U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke. I asked Elliot Woods, what has Zinke done most consequentially in his role as Interior Secretary? Tell us about how he's restructured the department.
Well, there has been this major attempt to restructure the department that at this point has mostly consisted of involuntary reassignments, and there's a perception among a lot of career employees at Interior that these mandatory reassignments are designed to force people to quit. So that is the most immediately powerful transformation that Ryan Zinke has brought to the Department of Interior. However, if you ask him about his long-term plans, he would like to see a restructuring that would make the Department of the Interior almost unrecognizable compared to the way that it operates today. So he has called for a restructuring that would reorganize the Department of Interior's major land management agencies, which consist of the National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and there's probably one that I'm forgetting right now, but the big ones are the BLM, the National Park Service, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which are primarily right now centered on regional offices. And he would like to see those reorganized along watershed lines or something similar that match the ecology. And then he would like to see mixed offices, which he says comes from Joint Special Operations Command or is inspired by Joint Special Operations Command, where you have, for example, Navy SEALs being directed strategically by somebody from the Army Special Forces or the Rangers or something like that. So the way that would look is you might have a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service supervisor overseeing a research team that included people from the Bureau of Land Management, the Park Service, et cetera.
Why?
And I've run this idea. Well, he claims that it would empower people on the front lines and get the decision-making process out of D.C., that it would just make more sense and it would be more efficient. But I've run that idea by a lot of people who have experience with these agencies either as employees or because they're involved in Western public land management issues. And nobody thinks that this is even remotely feasible, especially not in this political climate or at a time when the federal government is as dysfunctional as it is, because this is Zinke calls it a once in 100 years reorganization plan. But this is the kind of thing that's such a radical transformation that it would need to occur under a much more stable government than we have right now. And then even beyond that, people think that it's not a good idea, because the fact is there's a lot more differentiation between these agencies than their uniforms. They each have their own organic acts that give them authority to do their jobs. They each have their own cultures and traditions. They have different mandates and responsibilities. So it's not as if you can just shift one employee to another office from another agency and there's parity there. It's really not necessarily the same job that these different people in similar positions are doing. So I think the question was bigger than that, though. You asked about the reorganization, but did you also want me to talk about what Zinke has done as Secretary of the Interior that's really transformational or
absolutely
or has had a
yeah
big impact?
Yes.
So I would say the Monuments Review is obviously the big flashing red light, and that's because this is the first serious attack on the Antiquities Act that was signed into law by President Theodore Roosevelt in 1906, which was probably his single most important land preservation act. And what the Antiquities Act did was it gave the president unilateral authority. Congress delegated unilateral authority to the president to declare monuments on federal public land by himself. And each of those monuments has its own unique, locally tailored plan. So there is opportunity for certain historic uses to be preserved, et cetera. All of that is considered for each monument individually. But a lot of these landscape-based monuments, so for example, the Grand Canyon National Monument, which later became Grand Canyon National Park, they are protected at a level that is close to wilderness, or in some cases equal to federally designated wilderness under the 1964 Wilderness Act. So what the Monuments Review is doing is challenging the authority of the Antiquities Act, because President Trump has just modified an existing monument in a major way. And there's never been a legal precedent one way or the other that says that the president also has the authority to modify existing monuments. So the tradition has been that the president can create monuments, but that he cannot modify them. And there have been a couple of minor modifications early in the 20th century that were never challenged in court. But these are major modifications, and it is guaranteed that they will go to court. In fact, there are already lawsuits pending.
But you spoke to John Yoo, didn't you, about this particular issue, who is a conservative legal scholar who thinks that it is appropriate and legal to withdraw the designation just as much as they have the ability to impose a designation. Am I right?
Right. And Yoo's point is that when a law gives the president authority, it implies the inverse authority. So that's basically his whole argument. And it was an interesting discussion, because when we got further into it, you said, look, I think it would be much better. So Congress has always maintained the authority to modify monuments. That's never been in question. Congress could pass an act tomorrow repealing the Antiquities Act entirely, or eliminating the entire national monument system if they could get it across the president's desk. So it's important to remember that Congress has always had the authority to make whatever changes they want. But Yu's point is that the president has the inverse authority under the law. And because of that, the Antiquities Act has always been a weak foundation for large-scale landscape preservation. What he says is this was always a fragile foundation, but tradition made it so that we got carried away, essentially, and started creating these enormous monuments that were never as protected legally as people thought they were.
Is there no precedent for this? I mean, what about his predecessors, the president's predecessors? Have they not ever withdrawn designation?
Well, that's going to definitely be one of the major legal contentions in court. So there have been modifications to existing monuments a handful of times before the passage of the Federal Land Policy Management Act of 1976, which was a major attempt in Congress to clarify and define authority for the federal land management agencies. And since the passage of that act, no president has ever attempted to modify an existing monument in any way. Prior to that act, there were minor modifications, but these are major modifications. We're talking reducing Bears Ears by 50% of its size, and Grand Staircase reduction is something similar. And the problem with this is, if this succeeds, if this modification holds up in court, then the Antiquities Act becomes significantly weaker, because what president is going to run the risk of designating a large landscape size monument of 1 million acres or 1.5 million acres with the knowledge that when the political winds shift 2 or 3 years later, the next president can completely undo it? Because to put in these protections and to go through the scoping meetings and all of the negotiations on the ground about what historic uses are going to be permitted, to change the signs, to do all of those things, to do the science, the environmental impact studies, all that kind of stuff, requires a lot of manpower and a lot of money and political capital. So who would go through all of that with the knowledge that it could just be taken away as Bears Ears just has been? So the supporters of Bears Ears and the monuments and the people who would like to see the Antiquities Act clarified as a one-way authority to create but not modify are really hoping that their side holds up in court, because if it doesn't, then all of a sudden we have opened the door for presidents to basically do whatever they want with existing monuments. And now it's coming from multiple sides, because at the same time that this is going on, Congressman Rob Bishop, who is, again, the chair of the House Natural Resources Committee, he is the chief leader of the sailor transfer of public land movement. He's very much anti-public lands, anti-regulation, anti-federal management. He's introduced a bill to the House that would give, that would actually legally codify the president's ability to modify monuments. So while they're pushing this angle through the courts and hoping that Hail Mary will go, they're also trying to get a bill across the president's desk that would actually give the president the authority to change existing monuments. And if that happens, the Antiquities Act won't be worth the paper that it's printed on, in my opinion.
I'm Arun Vanagopal, and I'm speaking with journalist Elliot Woods about his profile of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke for Outside Magazine. Elliot, a central issue for the Department of the Interior at the moment is the proposed cuts to its budget for 2018, which the administration has proposed to slash by about 12%. And Zinke has said that, quote, his agencies are underfunded and overburdened. But you discuss with them how he's also proposed cutting about 4,000 jobs from the department. So what happened when you spoke to him and you brought up that number with him?
I should say the underfunded and overburdened, I'm not looking at a draft right now, but those might be my words paraphrasing Zinke's assessment.
Got it.
Just want to make that clear. But when we were fishing together by Lake McDonald in Glacier Park and I brought up the issue of the workforce reduction by 4,000, he said, "Where did you get that number?" And I said, "That's the number that I'm seeing everywhere." And he said, "No, you got that number from the Washington Post." And I was kind of taken aback. And I said, "Well, I've seen that number a lot of places." I said, does this mean there is not a plan to make a workforce reduction of that size?" And he sidestepped and went into an explanation about the reorganization and how there is going to be a workforce reduction, probably mostly in D.C., but some of those positions will be reassigned out west on what he calls the front line. But then I went back and looked at his congressional testimony from just a couple of days before our conversation, and there in the congressional testimony and the paperwork that he handed in, the number 4,000 is right there. He says this will probably imply a reduction of, you know, X number of people, which will amount to 4,000. So it actually came directly from his testimony. And I thought that was strange. Either he hadn't read it clearly or didn't know that it was in there, or he was actively misrepresenting what he had said.
What do commercial interests want to do at Bears Ears and Grand Staircase?
Well, Grand Staircase appears like it may have significant coal deposits that could be accessible with the new designation or with the reduced designation. And it appears that there may be interest from uranium mining in the area of Bears Ears. So those are both major concerns for extractive industry. But part of me thinks that what's really valuable here is just cracking the hull of the entire protective apparatus. You start chipping away at the places that are most protected, and there's a ripple effect where the places that are even less protected have less protection or are more vulnerable. You know, if the American public will stand for a national monument being reduced, and if the court system will allow that to happen, then that really gives a boost to people who would like to see regulations removed or reduced elsewhere, and for some of the protections that have been in place to prevent extractive industry access or other consumptive user group access in other places. So I do think the coal deposit that is supposed to be underlying some of the Grand Staircase terrain and the uranium deposits near the Bears Ears terrain are really important to keep an eye on. And there may be oil and gas plays there as well. I'm not an expert on those things. I was mostly writing about Ryan Zinke. But I think if you look at the broad spectrum of what's going on right now, this is an assault on the entire protection apparatus. We just saw a bill come through committee the other day, just 2 days ago, to amend the Wilderness Act to allow mechanized devices, including bicycles, in federally designated wilderness areas. This is a huge thing. Senator Steve Daines from my state of Montana just introduced a bill in the Senate that would legislatively withdraw protections from almost 500,000 acres of wilderness study areas in Montana. So this is coming from all angles right now.
Before we go, I'd like to talk about the issue of lease sales. Mm-hmm. You write that in October, Zinke announced the largest lease sale in U.S. history, involving nearly 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico, including areas where a moratorium has been in place since the Deepwater Horizon spill. And Zinke seems to frame this sale in terms of job creation. I'm just wondering how you explain this justification. Is there really a lot of jobs that can be created here?
Well, I think there could potentially be a lot of jobs created by expanded exploration for oil and gas on public land. But I want to return, if I can, to your earlier question about the ways that Zinke has been most powerful in terms of transforming the public land landscape. And this is it right here. He's pushing for maximum deregulation. He's issued a secretarial order to review burdensome regulations to industry. And this is all simultaneously, he has told his staff that they need to start pushing through and accelerating the permit approval process for exploration on public land, the leasing process. All of this stuff he's actually ordered to be expedited. And the really confusing thing, if you talk to people who understand the economics of the oil and gas industry particularly, or the coal industry, is that there isn't really a lot of demand for these leases right now because oil prices and gas prices are at rock bottom because of a supply glut and several other contributing factors that have combined to make oil and gas prices really drop. So you've seen a huge loss of jobs in states like Wyoming and Montana that have robust oil and gas industries in the last couple of years. And so the big head scratcher here is, why would Zinke try to auction off a huge number of public land natural resources leases now when it's almost certain that the auction prices for those leases are going to be very low, which means that the royalties that the public will receive will be very low? It's kind of like smashing the piggy bank when you only have 20% of it full. It's not a good return for the taxpayer at all.
So,
and at the same time, yes, go ahead.
So if you could just answer your own question, you said it's a head scratcher. Why do you think he wants to do it then?
Well, I am not an economist and I'm not an oil and gas industry expert, but I tend to agree with Mark Squillaci, who's a law professor in Colorado who studies environmental law and who talked to me about these issues, that this is a smash and grab operation. This is a huge favor to the oil and gas industry because if they can lock up, as he said, if they can lock up these leases at bargain basement prices, then when the market does shift and make it profitable to explore for these resources, they will have gotten them for almost nothing and they won't have to give us, the taxpayers, the U.S. Treasury, hardly anything as a consequence. So they get them for a cut rate, and we're stuck with the environmental costs.
I'm Arun Vanigopal, and I've been speaking with journalist Elliot Woods about his profile of U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke and the fight to preserve public lands in the U.S. Thank you so much for joining me today, Elliot.
Thank you.
Coming up, Emily Lin, Kweli Chanda, and Adam Peltzman on the WNYC Studios scripted comedy podcast for kids called This Podcast Has Fleas. And later on in the show, filmmaker Nancy Bursky with her documentary The Rape of Recy Taylor. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org.